Edgar Keret is an Israeli writer, best known for his warm and funny and surreal short stories. His most recent book, though, is a collection of personal essays called The Seven Good Years. And these are wonderful stories from the seven-year period between the birth of his son, Lev, and the death of his father. The years when Edgar was figuring out how to be a father while still feeling the protective presence of his own dad. These stories are so delightful and moving and entertaining, and they're full of tiny moments, little fragments of family life that mostly take place in Tel Aviv, a city living with the daily stress of bombs and rocket attacks. Hi, Edgar.
Hi.
I'd love you to start just by reading from your book, if you don't mind. There's a story in there called Call and Response. It just gives a lovely flavour of your writing and, yes, and your voice.
I really admire considerate telemarketers who listen and try to sense your mood without immediately forcing a dialogue on you when they call. That's why when Devora from Yes, the satellite TV company, calls and asks if it's a good time for me to talk, the first thing I do is thank her for her thoughtfulness. Then I say politely that no, it isn't. The thing is, just a minute ago I fell into a hole, injured my forehead and foot, so this isn't really my ideal time, I explain. I understand, Devora says. So when do you think it will be a good time to talk? An hour? I'm not sure, I say. My ankle must have broken when I fell, and the hole is pretty deep. I don't think I'll be able to climb out of it without help. So it pretty much depends on how quickly the rescue team gets here and whether they have to put my foot in a cast or not. So maybe I should call tomorrow, she suggests unruffled. Yes, I groan. Tomorrow sounds great. What's all that business with the hole? My wife next to me in a taxi rebukes after hearing my evasion tactics. This is the first time we've gone out and left Lev with my mother, so she's a little edgy. Why can't you just say, thanks, but I'm not interested in buying, renting, or borrowing whatever it is you're selling, so please don't call me again. Not in this life, and if possible, not in the next one either. Then pause briefly and say, have a nice day, and hang up, like everyone else. I don't think that everyone else is as firm and nasty to Devora and her ilk as my wife is, but I must admit that she has a point. In the Middle East, people feel their mortality more than anywhere else on the planet, which causes most of the population to develop aggressive tendencies towards strangers who try to waste the little time they have left on Earth. And though I guard my time just as jealously, I have a real problem saying no to strangers on the phone. I have no trouble shaking off vendors in the outdoor market or saying no to someone I know who offers me something on the phone. But the unholy combination of a phone request plus stranger paralyzes me, and in less than a second I'm imagining the scarred face of the person on the other end who had led a life of suffering and humiliation. I picture him standing on the window ledge on his 42nd floor office talking to me on a cordless phone in a calm voice, but he's already made up his mind. One more asshole hanging up on me, and I jump. And when it comes down to deciding between a person's life and getting hooked up to the balloon sculpture endless fun for the whole family channel for only 9.99 shekels a month, I choose life. Or at least I did until my wife and my financial advisor politely asked me to stop. And that's when I began to develop the poor grandma strategy, which invokes a woman from whom I've arranged dozens of virtual burials in order to get out of futile conversations. But since I'd already dug myself a hole and fallen into it for Devora of the satellite TV concern, I could actually let Grandma Shoshana rest in peace this time. Good morning, Mr. Keret, Devora says the next day. I hope this is a better time for you. The truth is that there were a few complications with my foot, I mumble. I don't know how, but gangrene developed and you've caught me right before the amputation. It will just take a minute, she gamely tries. I'm sorry, I insist. They already gave me a sedative and the doctor is signaling me to close my mobile phone. He says it isn't sterilized. So I'll try tomorrow then, Deborah says. Good luck with the amputation. Most telemarketers give up after one call. Phone posters and internet package sellers might call back for another round. But Deborah, from the satellite TV company, is different. Hello, Mr. Carrot, she says when I inadvertently answer her next call, unprepared. How are you? Before I can reply, she goes on, since your new medical condition will probably keep you at home, I thought I'd offer you our extreme sport package, 4 channels that include all the various extreme sports in the world, from the dwarf hurling world championship games to the Australian glass eating matches. Do you want Edgar? I whisper. Yes, Deborah says. He died, I say, and pause before continuing to whisper. Such a tragedy. An intern finished him off on the operating table. We're thinking about suing. So who am I talking to? Deborah asks. Michael, his younger brother, I improvise. But I can't talk now. I'm at the funeral. I'm sorry for your loss, Deborah says in a shaky voice. I didn't get to speak with him a lot, but he sounded like a lovely person. Thank you, I keep whispering. I have to hang up. I have to say Kaddish now. Of course, Deborah says. I'll call later. I have a consultation deal that's just perfect for you.
That's lovely. Are you sometimes paralyzed by politeness?
Yes. I think I'm a son of Holocaust survivors, and I think that when you grow up in a house where you know how much your parents had suffered, you become super sensitive to other people, and you really try all the time not to hurt anybody. And, you know, sometimes it reaches kind of a ridiculous extremities, you know. I remember when I was once with my wife in Italy, and there was a bench watching a fountain. And I refused to sit at the bench because I saw a couple of kids on the lawn. And I said to my wife, if we sit at the bench, we block the fountain view for them, you know, which started the fight. So I really all the time have to kind of remind myself that I also exist and that I may want stuff from time to time.
I interviewed Lily Brett, the Australian writer whose parents were also Holocaust survivors. She'd written a book about her experience as a rock and roll journalist in the 1960s, being around Jimi Hendrix and other people. And I asked her why she never ended up taking a lot of drugs and falling into that lifestyle. She said, I thought it would have killed my parents, and my parents had been through so much, I just couldn't have done it to them. It sounds like you felt that same obligation.
Yeah, I feel the same. And again, you know, it's really, my mother had lost both her parents and her brother when she was a child. She went through the war as a child, being a sole survivor of her family. My father survived the war, hiding in a hole he dug in the ground. So whenever you have to choose kind of between doing something that is uncomfortable, that would please your parents, or doing what you want, it feels so selfish doing what you want, considering what they've gone through. And the truth is that I think that this need to always kind of say the right thing is what made me a writer, because I think writing fiction was a way for me to express my true wishes and put them outside. You know, it was this only place where there was no collateral damage for admitting the fact that, I don't know, that I want to get drunk or laid or break things in the house, you know. So I could make up a character and he could do all those things that I wouldn't allow myself to do because I wouldn't want to hurt people around me.
Could tell me a bit about the circumstances of your birth and how your name, Edgar, comes from that.
Well, I'm the youngest of three, and my mother really wanted to have another child, and she went through a series of 5 miscarriages.
5.
And she wasn't that young anymore when she was pregnant with me, and because the umbilical cord was tied around my neck, and I had this illness where you become yellow.
Jaundice. Yeah.
The doctor said that I wasn't going to make it, and they wanted her to have an abortion, and she refused. So I was born in a cesarean operation on the 6 months of her pregnancy. I weighed 900 grams, and the doctors said that I'm going to die. So she named me Edgar, which means challenge, because it was a challenge to have me. And it's even funnier because my family name, Keret, means big city. So basically my name means Urban Challenge, which is an excellent name for a pair of sneakers, but a pretty strange name for a human being. And also, you know, in Israel, we have a compulsory army service. So, you know, it's very difficult to go through compulsory army service with the name of Challenge, you know, especially if you have, like, you know, a sergeant who wants to be a stand-up comedian would say, like, you know, Challenge, you have a challenge, go clean the restaurants, you know, so.
And he'd think that was hilarious, wouldn't he? You mentioned in passing just a bit earlier, Edgar, your father's experience of surviving the Holocaust. Tell me how that happened. What happened when he's from Poland, the Nazis invaded, how he was able to survive and hide?
Well, him and his parents tried to escape to a farm, and the owner of the farm, who was a very good person, offered them that they'll dig a hole in the ground and hide in it, and when the Nazis would come and search the farms, you know, and they would see that nobody's there, they leave, and then they can step out. But what happened was that the Nazis decided to build their headquarters in his farm, so they stayed in, but they were unable to leave. And he would kind of, you know, throw them a loaf of bread every day, and would take, the bucket with the urine and everything outside in the middle of the night when nobody would have watched it. But they got stuck in that hole, and because they didn't think that they were going to stay for very long, it wasn't really a big one, so they couldn't stand in it or even lie down in it. They could only sit in it. And by the time the Russians had invaded their town and liberated them, you know, all the muscles were contracted, and it took them some time to be able to walk again.
How many days were they in that hole for?
620 days.
Oh, man. Oh, 620 days? Not getting outside, waiting for the...
I think at some stage, you know, they were there with his sister, and his sister stepped out and was caught by the Nazis. And actually, she was tortured to death, but she wouldn't say where they were hiding.
How about your mother? Where was she?
My mother, she was in the Warsaw ghetto, but luckily she was moved with her family to another ghetto because... very few people had survived the Warsaw ghetto. And during the war, her mother and brother got killed, and also her father, who fought in the Polish uprising, got killed. So she survived the end of the war on her own, you know, and she was very young. She was 10 years old, but she had to take care of herself. And she escaped from the ghetto, and because she had the blue eyes and she passed for a Polish Christian and not a Jew, and that's how she was able to stay alive.
How important was storytelling to her in that time?
Well, one of the strongest memories she had from the Holocaust were the bedtime stories that her parents would tell her in the ghetto. And of course, they would tell her those stories orally because they didn't have any access to children's books there. So when she had a family, she wanted to do the same, and she would always... make up bedtime stories for us. Of course, my mother was well read, but she felt that kind of reading out to us a story from a book would be like ordering a pizza. You know, it's something that a lazy parent does. And if a parent likes his kids, so the same way you cut a fresh salad for them every evening, then she should make up a new story every evening.
And when she came to your bedside, was she making it up as she went along, or did she prepare it in her mind before she told you?
No, she would make it up as she went along. She was extremely good at it, and she would always have those things, you know, in those movies when they kidnap somebody and they hold a newspaper, you know, to his face, so you know it's a new photo. So she would always add details in the story that would make it clear that she's making it up on the spot. Like, she would integrate stuff that had happened to us or refer to something that happened in the news. And it was almost kind of like, you know, a show. But the thing is that sometimes she would work late and my father would have to tell us stories. And my father, who was a great storyteller, didn't have my mother's talent to invent stories. So he would actually tell me stories about stuff that had happened, like documentary stories, telling them to a 5 years old. And his stories were even more amazing than my mother because they kind of involved all kinds of situations that I would have never imagined, you know, that existed in the world. And the way that he would tell them, you know, you would always love all the characters, even though some of them did the crazy stuff.
Like what kind of stories were we talking about here? Where would they take place?
Well, they would always take place in a whorehouse.
Seriously? Your father really would tell you stories of things happening in a whorehouse?
Yeah, it was like, you know, the heroes of the stories were always like prostitutes, mafia guys, drunk people. And, you know, when you're 5 years old, you ask your father, Dad, what's a prostitute? And, you know, my father would say, oh, that's somebody who gets paid to listen to other people's problems. And I would say, and what's a mafia guy? Oh, these are those people who collect rents even from apartments they don't own. Wow, and what's a drunk person? These are people that have this medical condition that the more liquids they drink, the happier they become. You know, pretty early on, I decided that when I grow up, you know, if I couldn't become a drunk mafia guy, I must become a drunk prostitute because in his stories, it all sounded kind of so amazing, you know?
Why was he telling you stories set in such places?
So actually, when I grew up a little and I understood that there was something kind of wrong with the stories that he told me, I confronted him about it. And he explained that he wanted to tell me happy stories. And because I was a kid, he tried to kind of connect to his childhood. But his childhood wasn't a happy one, you know, going through the war and, you know, and
living in a hole.
So he said, I would fast forward in my life. And right after the war, he joined the Israeli underground who tried to fight the British occupation in Palestine. And they sent him to buy weapons from the Italian mafia. And the mafia people offered him to stay in one of their whorehouses because he couldn't pay for a rent. And he said, well, you know, this was the first time in my life where I didn't have to hide the fact that I was a Jew. And I would sleep full nights and I wasn't cold. So I thought, you know, maybe I could tell a kid about that, you know.
Oh, man, so that's where his happy life began then. Buying guns from the mafia in Sicily, that's when, and living in a whorehouse is when he was no longer fearful.
He was reintroduced to humanity because he said to me, the mafia guys, you know, they were nice. And he said, you know, well, sometimes they killed people, but at least when they did it, it wasn't like the Nazis. You saw how bad they felt about it. So I guess, you know, the idea was that, you know, that kindness wasn't an absolute thing. Compared to Nazis, those guys were kind. And for me, because this was my introduction to storytelling, I kind of instinctively understood that when you tell a story, you should advocate for humanity. You know, you should say, tell things the way they were, because that's how he taught them. But it tried to explain that, you know, that these are human beings there, and that, you know, even if they do wrong, you know, they're still human. And I guess that's what I still try to do when I write my stories. I once gave a talk in a maximum security jail in Israel. And the funny thing was that, you know, when I came there, actually the jailers really scared me because they told me if at some stage one of the prisoners stands, please just cover your face and turn your back. We guarantee that will hit him before he'll be able to touch you, you know? So it sounds like you're going to give a talk to Hannibal Lecter, you know? But all those people who were obviously murderers were very, very kind and very polite. And when the talk had ended and we started talking about the books that they like and the movies that they liked, all of them said that their favorite films were Dirty Harry films. And I said to them, you know, I don't know how to put it, but when you see Dirty Harry film, it kind of surprises me because, you know, it's about a policeman who kills criminals and you are criminals. How can you like such a film? And they say, well, you know, the criminals in the films, they're really evil. But me, you know, oh, I did stab this guy with a screwdriver 45 times. But if you would have heard the way he spoke to me, you know, I'm not like those bad guys in the movies. And I think that, you know, that we're used to seeing those kind of Star Wars and Lord of the Rings movie where the bad guys just laugh their evil laughs. But I think that, you know, in real life, most of the people who do the most horrible thing, they come out from some kind of a narrative that, at least in their minds, makes sense. So when you write a story, I don't write a story trying to alienate from those people who are doing something different. I try to humanize them, not necessarily to justify what they're doing, but just to remind us that they're part of the human family. And I think this is what writing is all about. When you read Lolita You know, it's a book about a pedophile. When you read Crime and Punishment, it's a book about a murderer. But still, reading them, you kind of recognize how those dark sides also existed in you, and how, aside of those dark sides, how some kind of humanity can exist also in the minds of people who do horrible things.
As the child of Holocaust survivors, and as a writer who is the child of Holocaust survivors, you would have had to think about the whole concept of evil quite a bit, I would imagine. Do you think evil exists in the world? Is there any such thing as evil? If it does exist, does it exist internally or externally?
Well, I must say something that my father had told me, that he said when he was a kid during the war, he said, "I didn't feel it was a fight between good and evil. I felt it was some kind of fight between bureaucracy and technicality and authenticity." Because he said the way that I see the Nazis wasn't like that they were laughing their evil laughter, enjoying to see a Jew bleed to death. It was just that they were so mechanical about it, that they kind of disconnected from their emotions, and they did something just kind of going through the motion without thinking or empathizing with the person on the other side.
Right, so your father saw it as a war against heartlessness.
Yeah, yeah. He always said to me that naming something as evil, it's the easy way out. And he says it's also very dangerous, because he says it's very much what was done to us. We were dehumanized. And the moment that you say, oh, these are not human beings, they're evil creatures, it doesn't matter even if you talk about ISIS, you know, or terrorists or mass murderer, that the moment that you say, oh, they're not human, you say, I can excuse myself from the complexity of a situation and simplify it. And he says, you know, you could say they're human, but they're terribly wrong and should be jailed or even executed, but you cannot excuse yourself from admitting the fact that they have a mind and a set of emotion and things that they care for and things that they don't care for.
Do you have your mother's talent for effortless invention as a storyteller? Can you just sit down and happily let it pour out of you spontaneously without structuring things in your mind beforehand?
I think I do. You know, I think it doesn't necessarily mean that I can sit down and write a story at will, but I can make up a bedtime story for my son at will, or I can invent stuff. It's not always good, but it's very, very easy for me to imagine and invent things.
And just when you tell a bedtime story to your son, does he feel the excitement of the improvisation, the excitement that you get, the little tickle you get when you're watching someone invent the story in their mind as they tell it?
We used to have those things that we call them remote control stories, in which I tell a story and he says action, and then I have to kind of slide it into an action mode, or he says cats, and I have to kind of integrate cats into it. And he, and you know, when I do it, I don't do it like kind of the next sentence. I kind of try to do it in a way as if I prepared something about cats and or action into it. But it always kind of impresses him how he can affect the story so immediately.
Has there been a moment when you've written something and looked at it and went, where the hell did that come from?
Well, I would say, I could say that about half of my stories. You know, I think, you know,
something appalling? Have you written something appalling where you've gone, ooh, that's a bit ugly. Where did that come from?
Many times. But you know, but when I write them inside a story, I never sense them as appalling. You know, I once gave a reading in Berkeley from my book, Suddenly a Knock on the Door. And when they had the Q&A in the end, this woman said, you know, I've read the book and the story that impressed me the most was the story about a parent who goes with his child to a playground, and when his child is being bullied by an older kid, it beats that older child. And she said, how could you come up with an idea that's so twisted and weird? And I was trying to think, and I said to her, you know, actually, I didn't come up with it. It's me. But whenever I go with my kid to a playground and a bigger kid kind of picks up on me, my first instinct would be to get up and kick that kid, you know, because it's just the correct height. You know, you can kick them in the chin and they would just flow a bit in the air, and then say to them, how does it feel when somebody bigger beats you up, huh? Is it fun now, you know? But as you take the first step, you say, whoa, that doesn't make sense. They're just kids, you know? They arrest me. I'm famous. It will be in the paper. And then you say to that kid, you know, let's play like nice kids, you know, and the kid throws hands at you, spits at you, kicks you and go somewhere else, you know. But this kind of first thought, I can only acknowledge them when I write a story. You know, in real life, if you'd say to me, did you ever think about beating up this kid? I would say, oh, no, never. Come on. You know, I'm a compassionate human being. I'm a vegetarian, you know. I wouldn't do that to a kid. But when I write a story, I suddenly see this kind of thing presenting itself, you know.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler, on air, online, and on your mobile.
One of the things that's a real background to these stories in your book is war, rocket attacks in Tel Aviv, where you live. Has that been a part of your life all your life, the war in the background?
Yes, you know, usually when I try to pinpoint things in time, when I remember things, the easiest way to do it is to remember between which two wars it took place, because there were so many of them that you can get a pretty exact fix if I was 7 or 10 or 12 at the time.
The very first story is the story of the birth of your son, which takes place at the same time as there's a terrorist attack. So you're in the hospital and there are people coming in and there's a journalist there who thinks you're there for the terrorist attack. It's sort of got this kind of black humor to it, the way you tell it. Nonetheless, does something like that take the joy out of the birth of your son, or is this just stuff that you get used to in the background?
Well, I think that you always think you get used to it, but you never do. And I think that in a moment before you become a parent, you say to yourself, what kind of a place will I raise a kid in? Will I play with him in a playground, or will I hide with him in a bomb shelter, you know? I guess in the end you do both. But I think that it's easier for you to just go through the motion and not ask yourself any questions. But in the moment that you become a parent, those questions are being asked by your kid. And the ability to kind of live in this constant present stops, because you have a kid and you must ask yourself what's going to happen when he grow up, you know, especially in Israel when you have compulsory army service. So you know that in 18 or 20 years from now, he's going to wear uniform. And in my case, you know, if our government won't change, maybe deal with policies that I totally don't agree with. So it's kind of always lurking there.
So this is a conversation you have to have with your wife then about, will our son do military service? But of course, that'll be his decision, won't it, when it comes to that?
Yeah, by law, it's his decision. But my wife is so fearful that she wants to kind of brainwash him for a decade to convince him not to go to the army. But for me, it's this kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't dilemma, because army service in Israel is not a luxury. And the idea is that you don't want to go to the army because it's difficult. It makes as much sense as not paying your taxes or driving your car in a red light, you know. So I think that if you're in Israel, you must serve. And I also think that it's necessary that the left-wing liberals like us would serve in the army. I was in the army for 3 years. I did the reserve duty for 20 years. And I always thought that, you know, that if we leave the army in the hand of the right-wing radicals who actually love to serve in the army for patriotic reasons, then we would be in a worse condition.
The final story in your book is a story about how there's a rocket attack in Tel Aviv and you play a game with your son, and you and your wife play a game called pastrami sandwich, where your wife lies down on the bed, your little boy lies on top of her and you lie on top of him. And it takes a moment to realize you're doing this to protect him, of course, in case the building gets hit. There's a point, though, I suppose, you have to have this conversation with your son and explain, this is what's happening at the moment. This is a thing I suppose has to happen with every family living in Israel at the moment.
Well, you know, I remember when my son was 6 or 7 years old, and it was the first time that he was exposed to missile attacks. And it is very scary, you know, you're in the middle of the street and there is an alarm and you lie on the ground, and a couple of times, you know, the missile explode above your head and pieces of shrapnel fall, and you know, I think it's scary for a grown-up, but it's even scarier for a child. And my son's reaction was that he talked to one of his classmates and they decided to build a bomb together and throw it on Palestinians. And I said to him, why would you do that? And he said, well, you know, you always said to me that I shouldn't punch other kids, but that if they punch me, I'm allowed to punch back. So he said, so if they try to kill me, you know, I should be allowed to try and kill them. And, you know, when you find yourself in this very awkward position where you tried to explain to your 7-year-old everything that you know about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And me and my wife found ourselves building this kind of virtual checkpoint in our apartment, trying to explain to him how Palestinians can't move from one place to another without going through checkpoints. And, you know, and when we just told him about it verbally, he said, you know, doesn't sound so bad. But the moment that every time he wanted to go to the restroom, we stopped him and asked him questions. Why do you want to go through? What's your name? And after a couple of times like that, he said, okay, I understand why the Palestinians are fighting us. You know, if I would be a Palestinian, I would fight us too.
Do you ever think of leaving Tel Aviv?
Well, I think that, you know, as a writer, I feel that more than living inside a country, you know, I live inside a language. It would be very difficult for me to imagine myself living in a place where I cannot communicate and hear Hebrew. And also, being a son of refugees, I was always raised under this idea that in Israel I may not like what's going on, but when I fight to change it, nobody would say to me, go back, you know, to where you came from, you know. So I guess in my nightmares I can think about not living in Tel Aviv, but in everyday life I just see myself fighting as strong as I can to make the reality around us better, because I really feel that, again, I have big problems with our current government, but at the same time, I really feel when I go in the street that I'm surrounded by good people, and that sometimes our prime minister is able to exploit their fears and despair and help them think that there is no alternative. But I'm pretty sure that there is one, and I'm just waiting, you know, for the right leader and the right moment to change that tide. You know, not so long ago, we had Yitzhak Rabin, our late prime minister, who was sending our country in the right route and was sadly assassinated. And I want to believe that it's only a question of time before we'll have a new leader who'll be able to change that tide.
So I get the impression sometimes that Israel is split between cosmopolitan, urban, 24-hour party town, high-tech Tel Aviv, and conservative Jerusalem. Is that a fair way of seeing the kind of divide in Israel at the moment?
Yeah. I really think that, you know, that we have a very big, liberal, open-minded community on the one hand, and a big group that I would say is more messianic and patriotic in that sense, that, you know, that they believe also that we're the chosen people, you know. And I think that, you know, when the big plan is basically to stall for time waiting for the Messiah to come and save us, you know, I immediately ask, what's our plan B, you know, because maybe the Messiah would be too busy to save us. Maybe we should do something and take our own fate in our hands.
How has that divide played out amongst your brother and your sister in your family?
Well, I must say, my sister is an ultra-Orthodox Jew. At the age of 54, she has 11 children and 19 grandchildren.
Wow, 11 kids.
Yeah. And with her, like, if there are many ultra-Orthodox people like her, they want the same thing that I want. You know, they're very, very liberal. The Jewish religion has a very, very compassionate side to it. But unfortunately, there are many kind of nationalistic Jews that kind of combine the idea of a country, flag, national identity, and some kind of a promises from God, you know. And this is when it becomes dangerous. I don't think that religion in itself is dangerous. You know, I think that religion can unite people and can create many, many good things. I think that when people exploit it to create some kind of reality that makes them feel that they're better than the others, and that's when the problem starts. So my sister is very religious, but I don't think that people like her are the problem. And my brother, he's in the radical anti-Zionist left wing. He started the Legalized Marijuana, a political party in Israel that almost got elected to the parliament. And for him, he's against the two-state solution. He's fighting for a one-state solution, which is something that I think would never work, but it's good to disagree with an intelligent person because it brings many nice arguments, you know, next to the dinner table.
You mentioned before you're a vegetarian. How did you become a vegetarian?
I became a vegetarian when I was 5 years old. My father took me to see the Walt Disney film Bambi, And so it's, there is this terrible scene that I don't know how they show to children, where the hunters kill Bambi's mother.
Yes, it's terribly traumatic, yeah.
And I started crying, you know, and I was pretty much hysteric, and my father didn't understand what's the big deal, you know, it's just a cartoon, and he asked me, why are you crying? And I said, they killed Bambi's mother for nothing. And I said, oh, no, they're going to make a steak out of her. And I said, I'm not going to eat Bambi's mother. And, you know, and since that day on, I'm not eating Bambi's mother or cousins or playmates. Or, you know, I think I'm not a preaching vegetarian. You know, I think that everybody should do what they want. But I see myself as some kind of a moral opportunist because, you know, when you live in the Middle East, every moral question has ambiguity. But one thing for sure, you know, if I won't eat meat, I'm not hurting anybody, you know. So if you can be right and at the price of just not giving up on some tasty food, you know, I think it's a pretty good deal. I don't know how to be right, you know. So this is the only place where I really feel this is a good decision to make.
Tell me about the meat substitute your mother found to serve you instead of meat.
Well, when I was 5, you know, there were no meat substitute anywhere, but she found this store where they sell you this stuff that is, I don't know, the texture was a little bit like cardboard, but if you put it in water, you know, it turns into something that I found very, very tasty.
And you liked it? Yeah.
I liked it a lot. And since it didn't have any name, it was called The Stuff. So she would kind of have, like, you know, she would have a stash of that stuff, and every day I would eat it, you know, and I think that's what sustained me through at least my childhood years.
Did anyone else like The Stuff?
Everybody liked it because, you know, because it had this kind of aura of something that you can only eat, you know, at our place. You couldn't eat it anywhere because it was kind of an invention that my mother had made. So regardless of the taste, you know, that it's kind of disputable. Some people liked it, some didn't. But it was like kind of this idea that if you want to eat a meal that nobody else ever had, you know, you must visit Edgar.
Okay, I'd love you to read another story from your book, which is called What Does the Man Say? It's sort of a nice little thing about fatherhood and daily life and the kind of brittleness of everyone's temper in modern-day Tel Aviv.
Yeah, you know, well, the difficult thing with those stories is that when people don't know me, they think I'm a nice guy, but when they read the stories, they realize that I'm not always a nice guy, even though I would like to be. The minute we got into the taxi, I had a bad feeling. And it wasn't because the driver asked me impatiently to buckle the kid's seatbelt in the back seat after I'd already done so, or because he muttered something that sounded like a curse when I said we wanted to go to Ramat Gan. I take a lot of taxis, so I'm used to bad tempers, the impatience, the armpit sweat stains, but there was something about the way that driver spoke, half violent and half on the verge of tears, that made me uncomfortable. Lev was almost 4, and we were on our way to grandma's. Unlike me, he couldn't have cared less about the driver and was focused mainly on the tall, ugly building that kept smiling at him along the way. He sang Yellow Submarine quietly to himself with words he made up that sounded almost like English and waved his short legs in the air to the rhythm. At one point, his right sandal hit the taxi's plastic ashtray, knocking it onto the floor. It was empty, except for a chewing gum wrapper, so no rubbish was spilled. I'd already bent to pick it up when the driver braked suddenly and turned around to us, and with his face really close to my 4-year-old son, began screaming, "You stupid kid! You broke my car, you idiot!" "Hey, are you crazy or something?" I shouted at the driver, yelling at a 3-year-old because of a piece of plastic. "Turn around and start driving, or I swear, next week you'll be shaving corpses in the Abu Kabir morgue because you won't be driving any public vehicle, you hear me?" When I saw that he was about to say something, I added, "Shut your mouth now and drive." The driver gave me a look that was full of hatred. The possibility of smashing in my face and losing his job was in the air. He considered it for a long moment, took a deep breath, turned around, shifted into first gear and drove. On the Texas radio, Bobby McFerrin was singing "Don't Worry, Be Happy." But I felt very far from happy. I looked at Lev. He wasn't crying. And even though we were stuck in a very slow-moving traffic jam, it wouldn't take long to reach my parents' house. I tried to find another ray of light in that unpleasant ride, but couldn't. I smiled at Lev and tousled his hair. He looked at me hard, but didn't smile back. "Daddy," he asked, "what did the man say?" "The man said," I answered quickly, as if it were nothing, "that when you're riding in a car, you have to watch how you move your legs so you don't break anything." Lev nodded, looked out of the window, and a second later asked me, "And what did you say to the man?" "Me?" I said to Lev, trying to gain a little time. "I told the man that he was absolutely right, but that he should say whatever he has to say, quietly and politely, and not yell." "But you yelled at him," Lev said, confused. "I know," I said, "and that wasn't right. And you know what? I'm going to apologize now." I leaned forward so that my mouth almost touched the thick, hairy neck of the driver and said loudly, almost declaiming, "Mr. Driver, I'm sorry I yelled at you. It wasn't right." When I finished, I looked at Lev and smiled again, or at least I tried. I looked out of the window. We were just easing our way out of the traffic jam on Jabotinsky Street. The hard part was behind us. "But Daddy," Lev said, putting his tiny hand on my knee, "now the man has to tell me he's sorry too." I looked at the sweaty driver in front of us. It was clear to me that he was hearing our whole conversation. It was even clearer that asking him to apologize to a four-year-old wasn't a really good idea. The rope between us was stretched to breaking point as it was. "Sweetie," I said, bending down to Lev, "you're a smart little boy and you already know lots of things about the world, but not everything. And one of the things you still don't know is that saying you're sorry might be the hardest thing of all. And that doing something so hard while you're driving could be very, very dangerous. Because while you're trying to say you're sorry, you can have an accident." "But you know what? I don't think we have to ask the driver to say he's sorry. Because just by looking at him, I can tell that he's sorry." We'd already driven into Bialik Street. Now there was only the right turn onto Nordo, and then left to Burr Lane. In another minute, we'd be there. "Daddy," Lev said as he narrowed his eyes, "I can't tell that he's sorry." At that moment, in the middle of the incline on Nordo, the driver slammed on the brake again and pulled up the handbrake. He turned around and moved his face close to my son's. He didn't say anything, just looked Lev in the eye, and a very long second later whispered, "Believe me, kid, I'm sorry."
Through that and a lot of other stories in your book, I get a sense of the kind of brittleness of life in Israel, the highly strung nature of life, living under constant war.
I think you're saying it totally right. And I think that only when I became a father, I became aware of that. Because when you're a father, you kind of you mediate between your son and the reality around you. And that makes you kind of become aware of all those things that you've always done and went through the motion without even criticizing them or asking them questions. And when you're a parent and you see this new mind trying to interpret them, suddenly it's kind of like you're being reintroduced to your life. You know, in this story, it's about a very aggressive side in me that I'm usually unaware of. But I remember another incident, you know, that I once went with my family to a restaurant when my kid was younger. And we got horrible service. And I said to the waiter, you know, the service was horrible. And he was very rude. And he said all kind of annoying stuff. And I found myself shouting in the middle of the restaurant. And then the owner came and I explained to the owner why I was angry. And he immediately apologized and he gave us free dessert. And on the way home, my son said to me, "Daddy, can I ask you for a favor?" And I said, "Yes." So he said, "Would you promise me that every time we go to a restaurant, you shout at the waiter? Because I really love those cakes they give us." And it's in a moment like that, you know, that you realize that inside your own narrative, you have this kind of self-righteousness and you think that you're fighting for justice. But what your kids sees really is how you humiliate other people just so you get something for free. You know, he sees it from a different angle. And I must say, that was the last time I've ever raised my voice on a rater, you know? So I think that while you try to educate your children in a kind of roundabout way, they actually educate you.
You have to really be conscious of the example you're setting for your kids. When my kids were born, I remember trying to tell myself, one thing I must not do is not to give them a hard time for things I see in them that I don't like about myself. You ever had that thought?
Well, there's so many things I don't like about myself that, you know, that if I would educate my kid this way, he'll become like, you know, a mass murderer. But I think that there is something about those dilemmas that there isn't an easy solution. There is a beautiful a song by a Belgian singer called Stromae where he says, everybody knows how to make a child, but nobody knows how to make a father. And it gets you thinking that, you know, that you need to get a license, you know, to drive a motorcycle, but that every dumb, irresponsible ass, you know, can become a parent. And when you become a parent, you just realize how unprepared you are, because there's something so vast and responsible about it. And nobody ever taught you, you know, how you're going to deal with this situation. You know, when I ride a car, I know what to do if the guy before me brakes, you know. But when your kid suddenly asks you this question out of the blue, when you find yourself in a situation that is totally unexpected, you say, where is the manual? You know, what am I supposed to do now?
Doctors located a tumor on the back of your father's tongue, which was eventually the thing that killed him in the end at the age of 83, I think it was, 83. Yeah. Why was he so upbeat about it all?
Well, I think that there is something about my parents that after surviving the Holocaust, they already kind of felt a priori lucky. So my father said to me, like, he had a smoker's cancer, and he started smoking when he was 14, you know. So he said, you know, for about 70 years, I've been smoking 2 packs of cigarettes, and now I get cancer. It's a fair deal, you know. If I would be 14 again, I would go for it. You know, smoking is fun. He fought, you know, to the last moment of his life to be as much alive as he could, because he loved life. But at the same time, he couldn't help thinking that he got a very fair deal, you know. He was kind of an incurable optimistic, and he always said to me, you know, if I would have been raised, you know, in a beautiful farm with good foods, then I guess people would always surprise me for the bad. But, you know, but when you grow up hiding from Nazis, then after that, everybody seems nice.
How did life change for you after your father died?
I still miss him a lot. And let's say if life is a war, there was always this guy in the ditches in front of you, in the front line, fighting for you. And the
Well, you felt his protection right up to the end. His
always, always. And, you know, whenever I would have a problem, you know, I would go and ask my father, and even on the way before asking him, I knew that he would smile and say, that's not a big deal, you know, everything's going to be okay. And I needed him saying it, and also because he was right, you know, he had gone through such an experience that it doesn't matter if, I don't know, bankruptcy, everything that you could imagine didn't seem like a big deal compared to them. He was truly fearless, you know, not fearless kind of in a Mel Gibson, a Braveheart kind of way. He kind of experienced life as having a one-day pass at an amusement park. So the idea that you're going to check out at some point is okay. They're going to close the park. But that you should feel lucky that you're there. And whatever happens, you know, it's going to be okay.
Do you still ask him for advice?
You know, it's funny because my son kind of believes in reincarnations, and he sometimes, you know, we can see a spider and say, I think it's granddad, you know. Mm. And but with me, I don't ask him for an advice, but I actually feel that with every passing day, I become more like him.
By that, I mean, don't ask the ghost of him for advice. But I mean, you just said to me, even when I would go to him and I would ask him for advice, I always knew what his answer was going to be. So there's a part of you that contains him in a way, isn't there?
Oh, I could repeat what he would have said, but the truth is that I'm too stressed to actually believe it. You know, maybe after you have to go through the turmoil that he had gone through in life to be so calm about crazy things happening around you. I know what he would have said, but I need to hear him saying it to be able to believe it.
Do you have this feeling sometimes, even though he's been gone for some years now, that he's putting things in front of you?
Well, I must say that, you know, that me and my father, we have the same foot size. About 10 years ago, he bought himself and me a pair of the same sandals. His sandals were black and mine were brown. And when he died, I made two pairs, that one of them is brown and one of them is black. And I still wear them, you know, even on this trip, I still wear them. And the idea is that I wear one of his sandals kind of makes me feel that he's with me.
Wonderful to speak with you, Edgar. I enjoyed your book so much, and thank you so much for being a guest on the program today.
Thank you. Thank you. It was amazing speaking to you. It's like I've never been to psychotherapy, but this is as close as it gets.
You can rise from the couch now. So.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. On air, online, and on your mobile.
Edgar Kerrod's book is called The 7 Good Years. abc.net.au/conversations is our website. All of our thousands of podcasts are available for you for free. And we have a Facebook page as well that I don't mention nearly enough. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.